beautiful photo of club moss and some leafy lichen and lots of things going on there. So if Instagram is good for anything, it's definitely good for Little Falls Phenology. It's always beautiful to see what they're doing. And those kids have been so active throughout the summer.
I know.
And
Chad Kadetz is the teacher there, and he does such a nice job. He's got these kids, and even kids that are long since removed from his classes are taking in the opportunity to add their pictures to the collection. Got some great pictures there. There's one of a wasp carrying off a bright green grasshopper. It's just incredible. Really worth your time. Instagram, Little Falls Phenology. Mm-hmm. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net.
We also thank Great Lakes Aquarium with its new exhibit, Lava to Lakes, offering a discovery into what was here before the land we call Minnesota, including sharks, jellyfish, and giant prehistoric fish. Hours and tickets at glaquarium.org.
We receive support from Lake Tax Advisors, where Ron Berg and his staff offer tax, accounting, and payroll services for Minnesota businesses with locations in Grand Rapids and Rush City. More information at lakes.tax. This is 91.7 KEXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are Northern Minnesota Radio. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KEXE.org.
For KEXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. A 26-year-old woman has died in an ATV crash in the Iron Range Off-Highway Vehicles State Recreation Area near Gilbert over the weekend. The Gilbert Police Department responded around 10 on Saturday morning. The woman, later identified as Tia Muller of Chisholm, died from being pinned underneath the ATV. The driver, 25-year-old Jonathan Muller, was airlifted to Duluth with serious injuries. Police learned the crash happened sometime the evening before, and the pair weren't discovered by other ATVers until the next day. Tia Muller was a volunteer firefighter with the Cherry Fire Department. The department said in a Facebook post that she will be truly missed. A 62-year-old Hopkins man has died following an ATV crash near Grand Rapids Sunday. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office states first responders located a man who was ejected from the vehicle on Prairie Lake Road around 8 p.m. Despite life-saving efforts, Rory Strachota was pronounced dead at the scene. Four girls were rescued after being stranded on Lake Superior near Silver Bay Saturday. The Lake County Sheriff's Office says the girls, ages 14, 13, 10, and 8, were paddleboarding to the smaller of two islands near Black Beach around 8 p.m. The girls lost their paddles, and waves on Lake Superior impeded immediate rescue efforts. Around 1 a.m. Sunday, a U.S. Coast Guard helicopter from Traverse City, Michigan, was able to transport the children from the island to a landing zone in the Silver Bay Business Park. Dozens of over 150-year-old tractors were on display over the weekend near the Itasca State Park for the Lake Itasca Pioneer Farmers 49th Annual Show. Farmers young and old from all over Minnesota and North Dakota took time out of a busy August to bring out their prairie and steam engines for the Case Expo. Exhibitor Ned Mars says he previously bought the scale model Case tractor on display for his 7-year-old daughter, who was splitting wood with her brother to feed the boiler. He says he values passing along these skills from generation to generation.
It's an important part of our heritage. I'm from North Dakota. My family originally homesteaded in southern North Dakota, and steam was actually what broke the prairie from where we were at.
Steam was an important fuel source in the pioneer days, and pioneers did their share of wood cutting. Steam also powers the Redby Mill. Lake Itasca Pioneer Farmers President Brian Misek says the mill is one of the show's more popular attractions.
The J. Neal's Redby Sawmill that was first put together in 1900 in Cass Lake, and it was later moved to Lower Red Lake in about 1930 and ran it through about 1962. And so it's a steam-operated sawmill, extremely unique.
The show is held the third weekend of August every year at the organization's 25-acre showgrounds. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host an open house on Wednesday as the agency plans to reconstruct a section of downtown Crookston beginning in 2027. The redesigned corridor will include a lane reduction to accommodate wider sidewalks and a bicycle lane, and will remove three traffic signals while installing new pedestrian crossing beacons. The open house will be from 4:30 to 6:30 at Crookston City Hall. The Department of Employment and Economic Development awarded contamination cleanup and investigation grants to three northern Minnesota cities in its latest round of funding. Floodwood, Virginia, and Two Harbors will use the money to assess and clean up sites for private redevelopment. The grant covers up to 75% of the costs of removing contamination at approved polluted sites. The Floodwood West Infrastructure and Housing Expansion Project was awarded $50,000 for a site that's historically been used for agricultural cropland and possibly vehicle maintenance. The city plans to redevelop the site into a mixed-use area that will include 30 rental units, 34 owner-occupied units, light industrial facilities, and new public streets and utilities. The city expects the project will create 14 new jobs, retain 14 jobs, and increase the local tax base by $127,000. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, Phenology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE.
We receive support from Clocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com.
We also thank the Loft Event Center in downtown Bemidji for their support, providing a multi-purpose event space that accommodates groups of all sizes, up to 150 people, for wedding receptions, business meetings, concerts, and more. Info about the Loft Event Center rates and packages at bemidjilodge.com.
Fog and drizzle possible this morning, then gradually becoming sunny. Highs from 76 to 82. Light north winds tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the upper 50s. Wednesday, areas of dense fog, otherwise mostly sunny. Highs near 81, calm winds. And on Thursday, mostly sunny. Highs 80 to 85 with a slight chance for afternoon showers in the Bemidji area.
Coming up, at 7:20 or so, we'll hear John Latimer's latest Phenology report. But right now, we continue with news from Morning Edition.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Now we turn to Moscow to hear how the negotiations might look to Russian eyes.
Yeah, President Trump and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky discuss whether Western powers could provide any security guarantees to guard against another Russian invasion.
Joining us to talk about what was agreed to is NPR's Russia correspondent Charles Maines. Good morning, Charles.
Morning, Leila.
Okay, let's start with this idea of security guarantees for Ukraine. How can we expect that will be received by the Kremlin?
You know, well, hammering out the contours of these security agreements for Ukraine is seen by the West as key to any future peace deal. And Trump began by saying that Putin was on board with it.
In a very significant step, President Putin agreed that Russia would accept security guarantees for Ukraine, and this is one of the key points that we need to consider.
And now Trump has said that that could involve Europe taking on a lot of the burden. That's a quote, but with some American support, which is obviously quite vague. So we heard several proposals out yesterday. Some argued that Ukraine should have what's called NATO-like Article 5 protections, the idea that an armed attack against one would be considered an attack against all. Others were calling for Western boots on the ground as peace monitors. But would that include, for example, American troops? We don't know at this point. One slightly more concrete security guarantee, President Zelensky of Ukraine confirmed that a Financial Times report that Kyiv wants to buy $100 billion, that's with a B, dollars in American weapons for its own future defense.
Now, Trump and Zelensky are calling for direct talks with Vladimir Putin. What's the Kremlin saying?
Yeah, you know, in the middle of yesterday's talks, Trump broke off for a phone call in Moscow with Putin, where Trump says Putin agreed to meet with Zelensky and also in this trilateral meeting. Now, late last night, Putin's aide Yuri Ushakov confirmed Putin and Trump had talked for some 40 minutes. And Ushakov said, and I'll quote here, the possibility of raising the level of direct contacts between Moscow and Kyiv was discussed. So you can take that however you like. Zelensky later gave his version in more succinct terms. Let's listen.
Росія запропонувала спочатку двосторонню зустріч. Україна, Росія.
So here Zelensky said Russia had called for a one-on-one meeting with Putin and Zelensky before a follow-on meeting that would include Trump as well. And Zelensky had accepted. He said that only on the level of leaders could the most painful and important issues be discussed. And this presumably would mean these discussions about possible future land concessions or swaps, in President Trump's words, as well as the return of prisoners and children abducted by Russia. But in terms of when, where, that's all to be determined. Germany's chancellor said it could happen by the end of the month.
And how do you see these demands going over in Moscow?
Well, you know, as we heard, Trump says Putin is open to security guarantees for Ukraine. But I think one thing we've seen time and time again is that Trump is moving fast and operating in broad agreements, whereas Putin likes to zero in on details, which slows the process down. Critics would say by design so the fighting can continue. I will say I heard a lot of red lines from Russian red lines in the discussions in Washington yesterday. You know, this idea of European troops on the ground in Ukraine, well, Russia's ruled that out categorically. Talk of Article 5-like status for Ukraine, well, Ukraine's desire to join NATO was one of the reasons Putin launched the full-scale invasion in the first place. And even Zelensky's calls for arms sales would seem to fly in the face of Putin's demands for Ukraine's demilitarization. So we'll see, but there's a lot of skepticism here, both from analysts and even pro-war nationalists, that Putin would or even could bend on these issues.
That's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
All right, let's get a view from Ukraine on this. Dmytro Kuleba was Ukraine's foreign minister from 2020 to 2024. So, foreign minister, do you believe anything is different today after yesterday's meeting?
Well, one thing is clearly different. We avoided a clash between President Trump on the one hand and President Zelensky and other European leaders on the other hand. That's a good news that they had a constructive conversation. But when it comes to substance, to meaningful, tangible outcomes of the meeting, everything is very vague and there is more, I would say, fog than clarity on future, on possible parameters of future agreement.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how you thought President Zelensky did, considering that the February meeting in the White House did not seem to go well. But if that is the most hopeful you are, Foreign Minister, I mean, that seems like it's bare bones in terms of hopefulness that something can be, resolve itself anytime soon.
Well, a long journey starts with the first step. And I was pretty certain that this meeting would go well because back in February, both sides went too far and they both realized that afterwards. So, but it's very important that the idea of a meeting between leaders is still open. It's very important that there will be follow-up conversations on what security guarantees may look like. To be honest, it's very hard to imagine what kind of security guarantees will be put in place to deter Russia from further invasions, but still this conversation is important. And but again, as I said, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And in this particular case, nothing has been agreed yet. It's just a conversation, an important one.
And all anything can do is just imagine what those security guarantees might be, because no concrete details have really been put out there. But I'm wondering if indeed, as President Trump says, a meeting between Zelensky and Putin happens next, can a peace deal happen without a ceasefire?
That will be very hard to imagine, but we should always reserve some space for the magic of diplomacy. But what President Putin is trying to achieve, he has repeatedly stated that he wants to remove the causes of the conflict. And although he claims that one of the key causes is Ukraine's aspiration to become a member of NATO, this is not entirely true. His real cause is the existence of Ukraine's statehood, and because he wants to dismantle Ukraine as a nation. And as long as he will not change this goal from unlimited to limited, and as long as he does not abandon this goal, there will be a war of a certain level of intensity. There may be ceasefires and they will be broken, but we need a decision that will clearly make Putin understand that the goal of dismantling Ukrainian statehood is unattainable for him. Then peace will come.
How likely is that, though, that he would abandon this goal, considering that it's seemingly been a belief of his even before Russia invaded Ukraine back in 2022?
Well, that's the most difficult question to ask. It's even more complicated than how potential security guarantees may look like. We should build a construction around Ukraine, a security and political construction, whereas it will be accepted as part of the West, and Putin will have to accept the fact that Ukraine does not belong to his sphere of influence anymore. Is this possible? Yes. Can you achieve that with one or two decisions? No. It must be a network, a complex of decisions that will build this wall between Ukraine and Russia, and we will be living our lives separately.
Does a timeline matter for you right now, considering it seems like there's momentum happening? Is that something that's tangible, or at this point it's been already so long that who cares how long it takes?
Listen, I live in Ukraine, and I experienced all the drone and missile attacks together with my compatriots. And trust me, there's nothing that you want more than for all of this to end as soon as possible, because it's a nightmare. It's a daily nightmare. But we know what we are fighting for, and we will keep fighting if this is the only option that we are left with.
Dmytro Kuleba is a former foreign minister of Ukraine. Thank you very much for your thoughts on this.
The Trump administration says detainees held at the site they're calling Alligator Alcatraz now will have their cases heard before immigration judges at another South Florida detention center. NPR's Greg Allen reports that immigration officials made that announcement in response to a lawsuit over the civil rights of detainees.
Lawyers who represent people held at the detention center in Florida's Everglades say they've been unable to meet with clients at the facility in a timely manner or in a confidential setting, and that outgoing calls by detainees are monitored and recorded. They say attorneys can't even confirm their clients are held at the facility because the Federal Immigration Detainee Locator website doesn't contain information about the Everglades site. Their lawsuit said attorneys have been unable to determine which immigration court has jurisdiction over their clients' cases. But in a document filed over the weekend, the Trump administration notified the federal judge hearing the case that it has now designated the Chrome Processing Center, another federal facility in South Florida, as the immigration court that will handle their cases. That answered one of the plaintiff's key demands, and U.S. District Judge Rodolfo Ruiz said it rendered the issue moot. Judge Ruiz said he's still considering the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction to force the state and federal authorities to ensure detainees' rights to legal counsel are respected. Lawyers for Florida, which built and operates the facility, said there are now rooms at the Everglades site where attorneys can meet and talk with clients in a confidential setting. A lawyer for the state chalked up any delays immigration lawyers encountered in meeting with clients as a, quote, natural byproduct of the facility being stood up quickly. ACLU attorney Eunice Cho said the court should not be satisfied with that answer.
People are being held at Alligator Alcatraz in horrifying conditions. Their rights are being violated on a daily basis, and it is not acceptable for the government to say, we're going to fix this later.
Yesterday's hearing followed proceedings last week in another lawsuit challenging operations at Alligator Alcatraz. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says he's expecting the judge in that case to rule that the hasty construction of the facility violated federal law.
This is a political thing. We get that. But we also know that we're right on the law. And if we don't win with the trial judge, you know, we'll ultimately win going forward.
Last week, DeSantis announced Florida was opening a second detention center at a shuttered prison in North Florida. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami. We'll be right back.
This is NPR News.
This is People Powered, KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr, sitting in for Heidi Holton today with John Latimer.
We receive support from Edward Jones financial advisor Christina Gallas, helping individuals and business owners reach their financial goals. More information at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
And Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXC in Bemidji. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxc.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month, and the board's meeting schedule is available at kaxc.org.
We're almost ready for the Phenology Show, and don't forget, Tornado Bob will be in a little less than an hour, 50 minutes or so. So if you have questions about the weather or the physics that creates the weather, please get in touch with us and send Jennifer a text at 218-326-1234.
Also, before 9 o'clock, we are going to continue our series on fires in Minnesota forests. Our producer, Mark Jacobs, has introduced us to Ben Benoit with the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. We're going to learn about traditional ecological knowledge.
Nice. Yeah. They used fire extensively to create their fields for growing things and just to kind of keep the brush down so they could get around. An interesting conversation with Ben, I'm sure. It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And we are climbing into fall very slowly and gradually so that you can get used to it and make your adjustments, find your long sleeve shirts, that sort of thing. But before we get there, there are a lot of events that will be taking place. And among them, blackberries are starting to get ripe. I ran into my first ripe blackberries around my house this last week. A plant called black chokeberry. Now, that's not choke cherry. That's chokeberry. The choke cherries around my house are pretty much gone. The birds have eaten them all. I did see some choke cherries here and there while I was driving around. But at my house, I have two black chokeberry bushes. One is a varietal that I got when I was buying plant stock from the soil and water conservation folks, and they were a long time getting to maturity. But boy, oh boy, now they just produce. There are hundreds of berries on that plant, and like the chokecherry, they have that astringent kind of a feeling in your mouth. But a little bit of sugar. The birds apparently don't feel that astringency. They just go ahead and gulp them down, and they will be starting to do that any day now, I would expect. I'll be watching to see. The other plant that is full of fruit, too, actually, nannyberry, which has a fairly large fruit. Right now they are green as green apples. And once they turn color, they'll get very dark blue to purple. And at that point, they are edible. I mean, they for all intents and purposes, are probably edible right now, but probably no sugar. When they get ripe and have a little bit more sugar in them, they're quite good. A bit pasty, more like a fig than say a juicy cherry or something. Not so juicy, more pasty. But the flavor is wonderful. Big seeds, though. So I when I come across the nanny berry, I pick a few and enjoy them. But I can't imagine, a pie or. Well, you probably could make jelly or jam out of them, I guess. It's probably some of you have. Maybe you'll tell us about it. Nanny berry, by the way, opposite branched. So if you're out looking around and you see this plant with opposite branches and bright green seeds on it, bright green clusters of fruits, chances are you're looking at nanny berry. Other fruits, well, other plants that are ripe right now, the oaks, both the bur oak in my yard and the red oak in my yard are full of acorns. It looks like it's going to be a bountiful year. I see lots and lots of acorns on my bur oak. I suspect that once they are ripe, and that should happen probably this week or next, the squirrels will come and cut them and haul them away. And I will not see very many white oak acorns actually make it to the ground. The red oak, on the other hand, will drop acorns, and underneath the oak tree, the red oak, it'll be like walking on ball bearings. It'll just be everywhere. And the reason for that is the red oak are not as tasty, nor are they as nutritious. They are not as nutritious as the bur oak. And they are not as tasty. They've got more tannin in them than the bur oak. And so the bur oak is the preferred acorn among those who sort of enjoy that kind of a meal. So keep an eye on your oak trees and watch what happens to the acorns and how long it takes for them to disappear. I suspect the deer will be eating the red oak acorns off the ground underneath my oak tree well into fall, but the white oak acorns will be long gone. And speaking of long gone, if you were thinking about hazelnuts this year, you're too late. Or maybe not. I don't know. At your house, maybe not. At my house, none. I've been watching them all summer, and last week, there were a few left out of... Well, this one shrub that I look at, an American hazel, probably had 30 or 35 nuts on it. And last week it probably had like 7 to 10 that were still on the plant. And this week, none. So hazelnuts, very popular among lots and lots of animals, just about every animal you can think of. That's tall enough to get in there, and some of them, like chipmunks and squirrels, will climb up. I once saw a woodchuck, a whistle pig, up in a hazel, chewing on the hazelnuts. So they are exceedingly popular when they're ripe, and those guys they're watching them, and once they become ripe, they eat them in a hurry. The other in the tree group that I've been looking at, the balsam poplars, the balm of Gileads. If you're driving down the highway this morning, look in the ditches. This variety of popple tends to grow near water, or it likes to be wet. It'll be very close to the bottom of the ditch. Seldom seen growing up on really high ground. Mostly because everybody else outcompetes it. But the balsam poplars are starting, they have this red, the underside of the leaf, the top of the leaf is dark green, the underside is light green and splotched with red. Red like a horse's red, you know, chestnut red. Anyway, as the wind blows, or just the overall color of the balsam poplars as you're driving down the highway is a bit to the brown or to the red side of things, and they're pretty easy to pick out. So if your eye is sort of accustomed to the colors out there, you'll look for the reddish looking green. And I know I don't know why that is, but for me, like if I look at a white pine, the needles appear kind of blue green. And if I look at a Norway pine, the needles are just sort of green. And when I look at a balsam poplar, the leaves are kind of reddish green. So you can discern them if you're looking carefully. They're going to start turning brown and they will begin to fall. They're not nearly as ostentatious as the maples, but they go through the same process. They go through senescence and then the leaves begin to fall. And though it hasn't begun at my house, I am seeing it around the area. So watch the balsam poplars in your neighborhood and see if you don't notice that they're losing their leaves as well. And the mountain ash, the native, the wild mountain ash, the one that grows in the woods and reproduces naturally, the Sorbus decora, northern or showy mountain ash. The berries are just starting to take on a blush. You can see the berries now. They're orange compared to the green foliage of the ash. Mountain ash, not at all to be confused with the black ash or the green ash or the white ash. The berries are just starting to turn. If you are in town, oftentimes there are varietals. There are other species of mountain ash that will have berries on them. And the phenology is not the same. The native mountain ash seems to be a little bit earlier in terms of ripening and disappearing because of birds. But check out the mountain ash in your neighborhood. And if they're growing in somebody's yard, they're probably not the wild or native mountain ash. Of the flowers that I've been watching that are in flower right now, bergamot at my house, the wild bergamot is at its peak here at KAXE, the rain garden here. They are past their prime. They are definitely on their way out, but mine are a little bit slower. Mine grow in a little bit shadier country, and so maybe that's why. Large-leafed asters are probably at their peak of bloom out in the woods. I'm seeing a lot of the hedge bindweed. That's the big white flower that looks like the tuba, the horn of the bell of a tuba. Big bell-shaped white flowers, sometimes streaked with pink. That's hedge bindweed. It looks, most people are going to look at that flower and go, morning glory. But morning glory doesn't grow here. Or at least it if it does, it's been planted by somebody. It doesn't reproduce and just be found wild in the woods. If you look at the leaf, the morning glory has a heart-shaped leaf and the hedge bindweed has an arrowhead-shaped leaf. Pretty obvious difference. Sawtooth sunflowers, those are, for the most part, most of the sunflowers you're seeing out there are probably the sawtooth sunflower. It, you know, if you look at a sunflower, the wild ones, you've got these rays of yellow and then the central disc, which is the flower itself. Looking around on the backside of that flower head, look at the green bracts that kind of close over the bud as it's developing. On the sawtooth, there are two layers or three layers, and they're quite pointed and they're hairy, especially near the base of that little bract. And that makes it sawtoothed and not the others, which are giant. And I can't remember the common name of it, but there are lots of sunflowers out there. Most of the ones that I am looking at are sawtooth sunflowers. Wild cucumber has begun to bloom, and this one is going to be, what you're going to see is sort of a vine, and it's going to be almost like a blanket of white laying up over some nearby structure. Maybe it'll be a fence, maybe it'll be hazelbrush, whatever's nearby. The cucumber is going to grow over it, and right now it's covered in these five-petaled white flowers that are pretty easy to see. And they'll see these big, like I say, big blankets of white kind of growing over nearby foliage. The gray goldenrod began to bloom last week on Tuesday, just after we talked. And the gray goldenrod, if you go to KAXE Season Watch page, I have posted a picture. And I described the gray goldenrod as looking a bit like a finger, slightly bent. So hold your index finger up and just bend it a little bit. And that is pretty much the shape of the flower of the gray goldenrod. Pretty easy one to identify among all of the goldenrods. And northern heart-leaved aster is also blooming. And that's just another of the many asters that come into the area. Among the birds, you may have heard earlier, Dave Lorenz mentioned that the orioles had left his area. I saw flocks of crows, grackles, and starlings this last week. I saw a red-tailed hawk. The pileated woodpeckers are bringing their juveniles to the feeders. Thank you, Emma Pearson and Phil Nealand, for pointing that out to me. I have had a pileated coming to my feeder, but no young so far. The American kestrels are still hanging out along Blue Heron Drive. And yesterday, for the first time all summer, I got a good look at my flock. I call it a flock now because the trumpeter swans nest on my lake. And I had been watching them and trying to assess how many babies they had. And they were always in the weeds on the edge of the lake, and I was never able to get an accurate count. Yesterday, I walked out, and they were right out in the middle, and there are six cygnets with them. Six. And they are big. They're almost the size of Canada geese now. So the trumpeter swans, I would say they've got a really good chance of bringing at least five of those to maturity. I hope all six of them make it. It would be wonderful. And the other thrill I had this past week was driving out my driveway and getting out along the hay fields that are there along Blue Heron Drive, and I saw two sandhill crane adults and a colt. So they had a successful year as well. They have a young bird in their group. So the trumpeters and the sandhills both came through big. Let's see. Woodbine, smooth sumac, maples, and spreading dogmane. All four of those plants are showing signs of fall color. Woodbine is turning red. So is the sumac. So are the maples. Some of the maples are turning orange. Spreading dogbane is turning yellow, and you're probably going to see a few bright yellow leaves on the bottoms of the milkweed plants as well. And then finally, insects. Still seeing a lot of monarch butterflies. I came around a corner the other day on Blue Heron Drive, and there was a puddling of clouded sulfurs, probably 30 or more of these yellow butterflies, and they were all in this area, probably about 3 feet square, and there was something there on the road or in the soil that they were gathering, some kind of mineral, some kind of chemical that they wanted, because there were a lot of them all piled up in that one spot. 12-spotted skimmer dragonflies, I have not seen any this past week, so they may be done for the year. The dragonflies I am seeing quite a bit of are meadowhawks. The males are red, the females are gold, and there are a bunch of them. There are several different varieties. And finally, flying ants. So if you are out there and on a lake especially, you may see some flying ants laying on the water. It's the ants that build those little volcanic-like cones in your yard. They are sometimes called the Labor Day ant because it's around Labor Day that they begin to send out their elites, their winged females and males. And so that is just about to take place, or is beginning to take place, and you'll want to check that out. Finally, at last, he's near done, lilacs. I was looking at my lilacs, and they did not look good. And so I went in and checked them out, and they have a fungus, and you probably are seeing the same thing. Lots of lilacs are dying right now, not dying, but the leaves are dying, and this is a fungus that can afflict the lilacs, and it's not going to kill the lilac, but there are some things you can do to help the lilac. Now, oftentimes what happened at my house last year was all the leaves fell off And then the plant began to re-leaf in the fall. And I had a number of people tell me the same thing. And some people actually had flowers on their lilacs last fall. A response to losing these leaves to the fungus. You can reduce the stress on your lilacs if yours are like mine and they're brown right now. You can reduce the stress by watering, especially if it stays dry. Give them plenty of water. You can mulch around their bases, which will help to conserve the water. You should rake up and destroy the infected leaves that fall off the plant this fall. And you might want to thin the plant, cut it out a little bit, cut some of the bigger, older stems out to improve air circulation and light penetration. You know, the less crowded your lilac bush is, the better chance it has to fight off the fungus. Fertilizing lightly next spring may help to improve the vigor of the plant, especially if the plant has been defoliated for, say, the last 2 years, which is my case. Fungicides can be used as the leaves are emerging and expanding in the spring and early summer. But typically this time of year, fungicides are not going to do anything to the fungus that's already in the plant. They're going to have no effect on the disease. So if you are thinking of using a fungicide, do it in the spring when the leaves are coming out. That should take care of your lilacs. That's the Phenology Show for this week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again next week.
It is about 7:42. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show here on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with John Latimer. We'll have John's phenology report up at our website in a few days for you to re-listen to if you need to. In case you missed it.
I think once is enough. Why torture yourself?
Well, you know, it's radio. People are in and out.
Yep, that's right.
So.
I had to go back and rescue the oatmeal from the burner, and and I missed that part about the lilacs. So, yeah, it's always fun. Sorry to be so wordy, but there's a lot of things to talk about and a lot of things to make you aware of. And, you know, the more aware you are of the world you're living in, the healthier you'll be. It is well known that a bit of time spent outside is good for you mentally and physically.
Yes, indeed.
It is time for best wishes. And you can send us your notable dates, birthdays, anniversaries, that sort of thing. We would love to hear from you and add you to our list. We do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday and happy anniversary. And for today, August 19th.
Well, first, we do our best. We announced someone yesterday, and then I learned their anniversary is today. So happy anniversary to Edith and Booka Michael spending their summer here on Pekigma Lake and also spending some time in Texas the rest of the year. So.
Yeah. Happy anniversary. I had no idea. My anniversary was on Sunday, by the way. In case you missed it.
We announced it yesterday. We did our best, and I think we got that one.
Yeah, 47 years. Whew. Seems like just yesterday. Well, in the birthday department, Keith Katsonis, I'm going to try, Katsonis, is having a birthday today in Edina. Iona Meyer is 75 today, and she lives in Palisade. Iona, happy birthday. You know, there was a time when I was twice as old as you. I was two and you were one. But you're catching up. Now you're just a year younger than me. And Sandy Hill is having a birthday today. Happy birthday to all of you. Sandy is in Hibbing. And if you have a birthday or anniversary to share, you can text us at 218-326-1234.
Also, if you have any weather questions for Tornado Bob, we already have a question here from Lisa wondering about auroras tonight, so we will ask Bob about that. But if you have questions too, feel free to text us, 218-326-1234. We're going to hear some new music now from Taj Mahal and Keb Mo. They have an album out called Room on the Porch, and this one's called She Keeps Me Moving.
She got my back, she's in my corner. She keeps me right when I go wrong. When I can't take it any longer. When I get weak, she makes me stronger. Got me singing. Sometimes I weep, sometimes I wonder. She pulls me up when I go under. She got me doing just what I order. If I want some wine, she brings me water. She got me singing. I'm gonna say it, let me say it now. Tell you what,
it ain't easy to comprehend. I got a lover and a real good friend. Somebody to count on, who I can depend on. Somebody to love me to the bitter end. Sure enough, I will.
Taj Mahal and Keb Mo, She Keeps Me Moving. Their latest release is called Room on the Porch. It's a follow-up to their 2017 album called Taj Mo that they did.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, great music. I enjoyed that very much. That was just the right beat to pound the lumps out of your oatmeal.
Support for KAXE comes from Beltrami Electric Cooperative, your Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing energy to keep lights on, coffee hot, and batteries charged. Connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years, More at BeltramiElectric.com.
We receive support from Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, helping guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More at ColdwellBankerNorthwoods.com.
Taking a look at where our current temperatures are, we have 68 in Grand Rapids and Brainerd, 66 in Hibbing, 69 in Aiken, and 67 in Bemidji. Dense fog advisory is in effect until 9 a.m. this morning for much of northern Minnesota.
We heard it from Sand Lake.
Yep, in Balsam Township, north of Bovee.
Yep, saying that couldn't see across the lake this morning. So
let us know if you're dealing with some of that. You can text in 218-326-1234.
If you're driving in the fog, slow down. Don't scare yourself or anybody else.
And headlights on, but not your brights.
Right. Yeah, the brights don't work so well in the fog. We receive support from Cass Soil and Water Conservation District, offering the Managing Your Woodlands for Wildlife workshop on Saturday, September 6th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. at the Walker Area Community Center. Registration is available by texting the word WOODS to 218-833-2492.
And Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers guided hikes on their trails the third Thursday of each month. That would be this coming Thursday at 9:30 in the morning. Hikes are 1 hour long and dogs are welcome if they're on a leash. Also happening this weekend, the 19th annual White Oak Antique Tractor Show is Saturday and Sunday, 1 mile north of Deer River on Highway 6. Each day will feature a pancake breakfast and parade, as well as demos throughout the day. A raffle for a 1947 Farm All tractor and a farmer's market that's free and open to all. We're going to have some more news from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. And coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Tornado Bob about the big weather picture and learn about traditional ecological knowledge with Ben Benoit.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. The national fight over redistricting is escalating, and lawmakers in Texas and California are back to work in their state capitals.
Texas Democrats returned after fleeing the state for 2 weeks. They were stalling a newly drawn congressional map driven by President Trump. It was loud yesterday as they entered the House chambers in Austin and supporters cheered them on.
One reason they're back, California. Democrats from the Golden State have released a map to counter Texas. It could lead to 5 more Democratic seats in the U.S. House to offset the expected 5 new Republican seats in Texas. With us this morning to break it all down is Laura Fitzgerald with CAP Radio in Sacramento. So, Laura, what do we know so far about the new map in California?
So, like you mentioned, it aims to flip 5 congressional districts that Republicans hold in California. And it puts together somewhat unlikely areas. For example, one district would include communities in Modoc County all the way up north near the Oregon border, with Marin County, which is way down near San Francisco. Those are 2 very politically different regions, and under this proposal, they'd have the same congressional representative. Democrats here say the plan is to vote on the map this week, and then this'll go to the voters so that they can have the final say in November.
Yeah, Modoc and Marin are as different as anything could possibly be. How are Republicans responding?
Well, Republicans strongly oppose the measure, and just some context here. The reason why California is going to the voters is because the Independent Redistricting Commission that we have here is in our state constitution. So Republicans are criticizing Democrats for sidelining that. Here's the Assembly's Republican Minority Leader James Gallagher talking about that at a press conference at the Capitol yesterday.
We should not abandon the principle of fair and independent redistricting here in California just for political expediency. But that is exactly what these maps do.
California's Republican congressional delegation has also spoken out against the bill. Republicans hold 9 out of the state's 52 congressional seats. One of them is Congressman Kevin Kiley. He's actually introduced legislation in Congress to ban mid-decade redistricting nationwide that would include the GOP-led effort in Texas. It's important to note here also that his district east of Sacramento is one of the 5 that could become bluer under the proposal.
Yeah, so what are you watching next?
Well, this proposal's on a tight timeline. The new map was just released late last week on Friday evening, and the measure was formally introduced yesterday at the Capitol. In order to get this in front of voters in November, lawmakers have to pass the bill by a 2/3 vote this week. Democrats do hold a supermajority in California's state legislature, so that passage is likely. After that, voters will weigh in on November 4th. Governor Gavin Newsom and Democratic lawmakers and the state's organized labor leaders, they've already launched a campaign for the measure, urging voters to support it before lawmakers have even sent it to the ballot. And meanwhile, Republicans are threatening to file lawsuits challenging the ballot measure. And one more thing, Democrats here say they will back down on the redistricting fight if Texas and other red states do too.
Any indication of how California voters feel about this?
You know, there's some early polling out there that shows that there's a slight majority of Californians that do view this favorably, but it's still very early in the process.
All right, that's Laura Fitzgerald, political reporter with Cap Radio in Sacramento. Laura, thanks.
Thank you, A.
As California lawmakers push to approve a new congressional map, Democrats in Texas have ended a 2-week walkout. One of those Democrats is Representative Mahela Plissa. She's the vice chair of the Texas House Democratic Caucus, and she joins me now. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So the walkout is over, but the reason for that walkout is not. Republicans are still planning to vote to redraw congressional maps in their favor. So what did this walkout actually accomplish?
Well, this walkout accomplished 2 things, right? First, we were victorious in being able to kill the first called special session that the governor called that we saw was really just focused on power grabs that Donald Trump asked our governor for. Mm-hmm. And the second is that we started really a nationwide movement. We've woken people up to what's happening, not just in Texas, but around our country. And we're getting people involved. Really, this is their representation that's at stake. And so I'm just really proud to have met this moment and started this movement.
Okay, so national attention was something that was gained, but the proposed redistricting is still on the table and is expected to pass. So what are Texas Democrats planning to do next?
Well, we had to come home for the legal battle, right? Our election experts told us that we too are on tight deadlines to make sure that these maps make it in the courts and they're litigated on. We feel very confident after we just saw the Fifth Circuit Court in Louisiana rule against a Louisiana redistricting map that was racially gerrymandered. And so we have to go back to the House floor. We have to make the legal arguments on the House floor during legislative debate as to why these are racially gerrymandered maps. And we hope that when it makes it to the Fifth Circuit Court, they too will find in favor that these maps were racially gerrymandered and stop this power grab.
So your faith is with the courts. I wanted to ask you about California, though, which we just heard about. You know, Democrats there are moving to redraw congressional maps in response to what's happening in your states, basically mirroring the effort to give Democrats more seats in California if Texas does what it's doing. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that Democrats have to meet fire with fire, right? If Republicans are choosing to change the rules in the middle of the game, Democrats have to be willing to play the new game. Look, we have always been for independent redistricting commissions. Every time we see Democrats take the gavel or take a governorship, they move to make our maps more fair, whether it's including independent redistricting committees in state constitutions like California does, or they make the system more arduous to change these maps like New York has done. And so we have always played by the rules. I think our fear is that Donald Trump isn't playing by any rules. And our concern is that if he is able to be successful in this power grab, we will see more big, bad bills. We'll see more cuts in Medicaid and Medicare. We'll see you know, Social Security be done away with, and we might even see national abortion bans go through.
And really quickly, you lead a politically divided district in a Dallas suburb. What have your constituents been telling you?
I represent one of the only swing districts out of the 150 districts in the House. And my constituents don't want us to be representatives of Donald Trump. They want us to listen to their needs. Texas just suffered a catastrophic flood. We lost over 130 people. Children were in that number. We should be focused on those people and their loss. We have a state where we're one of the lowest in per pupil funding for public education. And we need to be focused on those
issues.
We'll have
to leave it there. That is Democratic State Representative Mahela Plissa of Texas. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to